Hey, welcome to Everyday Non-Ordinary. My name is Jenny Wiener. I'm a psychedelic-assisted therapist based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and this is my podcast about psychedelic integration. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Valeria McCarroll, and we are discussing her work as a psychedelic integration therapist and trauma therapist, as well as a really unique framework she's developing, an embodied framework for integration that she calls Somadelics, which comes out of sort of a culmination of many of her intellectual and personal interests and pursuits. And it's just really fascinating. This conversation reminded me of episodes prior, such as ones with Kyle Buller and Geeta Vaid, and other folks who are just so clearly so, they've been so deeply studying these subjects and this work for so long. And it's really humbling and inspiring speaking with people like this who are just so deep in their craft and this work. And it makes me really excited as I continue on this path of learning more in my role. So I hope you enjoy, and I will catch you on the other side. Hi, Valeria. Welcome.
Hi, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I always like to start these conversations just by asking folks how they found their way to psychedelics. How did you find your way to this work, or how did it find you?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one I've been thinking about quite a bit, actually, as I've been working on a chapter for my book. And, you know, to me, there's a slight difference between my entry into recreational psychedelic use and my entry into therapeutic or ceremonial psychedelic use. And both have sort of a background of an interest in consciousness. But, you know, I think my entry into therapeutic psychedelic use really came out of desperation, actually. And I had been, you know, in a body of deep work. I was in the process of getting licensed as a marriage and family therapist and was in therapy myself as part of that process and to do work on myself, and really found myself frustrated with the limits of traditional talk therapy. And even though I was working with a very skilled somatic therapist and there were somatic elements to our work, kept bumping into in myself a lot of theoretical knowledge about what needed to change, and this what felt like a wall of just not being able to actualize it or really embody the changes that I knew I needed to make in myself. And I was going to school at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and there are a lot of different alternative modes of healing there, and had heard some about working with psychedelics and the capacity of psychedelics to support healing on deep levels. And so sort of out of a moment of desperation in my own process, connected with someone who had connected with someone, and through a series of connections found my way into an ayahuasca circle. And that was really my first entry. And I wish I could tell you that, you know, my first experience had been fabulous and I resolved all my trauma and here I am, but that wasn't it at all. It was actually miserable the first several times I ever worked with that medicine. But I kept going back. You know, I think most rational people, somewhere around, you know, the second or the third time of this being horrible and just crippling nausea and misery for hours, would have quit. But I'm apparently quite a stubborn human being. And I also wanted to understand why these other people kept showing up month after month, or whatever pace they were emerging at and attending these events. And so I persisted, or ayahuasca persisted. I'm not sure who was persistent in that process, but eventually had a very profound experience of purging. And I really don't like throwing up. Mm-hmm. I find it somatically very uncomfortable, and it bumps up against all my control stuff. But had just this glorious experience of vomiting rainbows. and the next day, I have such a powerful somatic memory of of the next day feeling so peaceful internally. And this, you know, retrospectively, I can look back and be like, oh, I was in a pretty much a constant state of hyper arousal. My nervous system had just never unwound itself from some sexual trauma that had happened several years prior. And really looking at that moment, you know, as a series of moments in the healing journey, but that particular moment as a space where I experienced my body so differently, and that being such a profound place of insight for me, of like, oh, it can be like this inside, really? Okay, there's something really here. We're all looking for what works and for whom and when, right? That's the great Ayurvedic maxim, and not at all to discount therapy, because I'm a therapist and I've used therapy a lot in my life and it's been very helpful at different moments. And at that moment in my own journey, I needed something different, and something that was really dissolving of the boundary between self and other. I think there's something, you know, no matter what you do in therapy, you're still in a room with another person. And so inherently there's going to be, you know, I'm over here and you're over there. And always there's going to be a level of ego relationship in the room, and a complex set of power dynamics by virtue of the fact that you have a therapist who you're paying, and to say nothing of someone's positionality around race or class or education or background. And I think one of the places psychedelics are really interesting to me is that you're taking in something, you're bringing in a spirit or an entity or a medicine into your body. And so necessarily that sense of separation between inner and outer landscape is already going to be different. You know, that was really where my work needed to happen. And you can't argue with your inner experience in the same way you can argue and pathologize and make someone who's outside of you wrong.
Right. Yes. Right. And when your inner experience becomes sort of the embodiment of something you didn't believe was possible, now that door is open, right, to the possibility of living that way or reconnecting to that in an ongoing way, in a way that just talking about it, even like practicing somatically, right? There's sort of this edge that sometimes I find hard to get beyond, and it's just a totally different experience.
Oh yeah. I mean, we believe what we experience. Ultimately, we can say that we believe in theories and laws and the way things should be, but ultimately we trust our guts and our inner knowings, or we're taught to dissociate from that knowing at great cost. And the experiential reality of being in the body and having a different way of being in the world than one normally inhabits is such a different way to learn than to talk about theoretically what it would be like if I, you know, believed that I was a being worthy of love versus being in, oh no, I'm totally a being worthy of love.
Right. I am love. I just have exactly love. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So that was sort of your personal entree into this work. You were already on the path to becoming a therapist. How did these paths start to intertwine?
Yeah, well, you know, I had a bit of a crisis when I was asked to define who I was as a therapist, which is what they ask you to do at CIS in your last semester of grad school. You know, you take your integrative seminar and you make your website and you're like, here I am. And it's like, well, but I'm still not sure I think therapy works, and I have an issue with that word. And I had been working in different ceremonial contexts with medicines, but that was sort of a point at which I began to deepen my study, and ultimately went through CIS's certificate in psychedelic therapies and research. It was in their inaugural program, and have studied psychedelic medicine or psychedelic assisted therapy. There's so many different terms in a variety of contexts since then. And as I began to launch my, I sort of begrudgingly was like, all right, I guess I'm going to do the practice thing. Because I really do enjoy working with people. I just get very caught up in the terms and defining how we're doing what we're doing. And, initially my practice had been focused on eating disorders, which is the thread you and I have in common. And then as my own area of interest began to sort of shift towards psychedelic assisted therapy, I began to shift the focus of my practice to integration support and really working with primarily women, but some men who are healing from trauma in some way, shape, or form, mostly sexual trauma in my own work. And that's been where my practice has stayed focused until today. And it's been a wonderful place to bear witness and to come to know how psychedelics have the capacity to transform trauma and engender great change in people's lives. So that's been sort of where my practice is. And then I'm not one of those people, I guess, who can have their work just be their work. I have to feel, I don't know, integrous across all aspects of my life. So I eventually went back to CIS and pursued a PhD in their East-West psychology program and wrote my dissertation on, it depends on who you ask, but really I was having an argument with dead Indian men from the 11th century.
I hate when that happens.
I know, it's 2.5 years of arguing with these these gentlemen, but I had a Kundalini awakening while working with psilocybin in Mexico in an indigenous context. And in my own process of integrating that, had decided I really needed to understand what other people thought Kundalini was and what the process of awakening is, and the intersection of psychedelics and spiritual practice being so alive in my own experience. And well, what does it even mean to be in a spiritual practice, and what does it mean to wake up today? And so wrote a very long dissertation about a lot of those things. And ultimately my work today is really at the intersection of psychedelics and spiritual practice, but understanding and thinking about spiritual practice as a process of developing awareness of how systemic oppression lives in our embodied experience, and using the potency and capacity of psychedelics and expanded states to develop awareness of where those contractions are in our somas and unwind them and possibly even install patterns that are more liberative and less based in domination inside ourselves. So that's really where my work is today. I also teach at CIS. I just can't get away from them. And I'm writing a book. So I'm integrating the possibility of psychedelics in all facets of my life.
I know when I was looking at your website and your materials, there was this phrase that really stood out to me, the sacred pain of healing work. And that just really summed up for me so much of what especially trauma work is. And just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, what that means to you and looks like in your practice.
Sure. I know we live in a culture that pathologizes pain. And if we're in pain, something is wrong, right? Pain is equated with wrongness or badness, or it's a problem, which is probably based in our, our capitalistic society that's like, well, if you're in pain, you're not a good producer, so we should give you a pill to fix that and you should get back in the mechanistic production line. But and I want to also put somewhere in there the difference between pain and suffering, right? This idea that being in a body, being in Earth School, there are naturally going to be situations that are painful. It's unavoidable. We stub our toes. We, accidentally burn ourselves on the stove. We trip and fall. It's part of being in a body is experiences of physical discomfort, or emotional discomfort, or spiritual discomfort. But that in our culture today, we've lost the the structures that really honor the pains of transformation, that to become something different, to move ourselves around the developmental wheel and become full, healthy, whole, integrated human beings is not an easy process. And often it's a very uncomfortable one. Caterpillar in the chrysalis, hard to imagine the total dissolution of one's being into goop is comfortable. And we have this bias in Western culture, not all cultures, but in our modern Western culture, you know, we have this bias of awakening should be all opening to love and light, and you have no pain anymore, and everything's amazing. And there are moments of that, but ultimately, I think that trajectory leads us to further disembodiment and, you know, towards continued desecration of the earth and denial of the incredible issues we face collectively. And so I have an interest in rendering pain sacred. My husband calls it ennobling the pain of awakening and or the pain of doing one's work. And I was an initiated student in a school of traditional tantra for many years, not neo-tantra, sort of what we think of as sacred sexuality today, but really classical tantra, those same dead Indian men I was arguing with. And I really fell in love with the dark goddesses, you know, the Kali and Durga and these goddesses who are very wrathful. I think there's a such a missing component in the feminine of honoring the darkness and the fierceness and the, you know, the willingness of Kali to just cut your head off because that's what you need to awaken, or the compassion that comes from wrath and anger and setting boundaries and really being like, no, stop, this isn't working. And so that kind of pain, those are the pains that I'm wanting to make sacred, are the pains of saying no, the pains of setting boundaries, the pains of letting go of a part of yourself because you know it's not serving you and your well-being. You know, even though it's ultimately in service, it's still hard. There's still pain. There's still loss.
Yeah, I really appreciate that distinction. And it's also sounds like so much just about changing our relationship to pain.
Yeah, well, we're, I don't mean to denigrate the medical paradigm, because if you break your arm, the emergency room is exactly where you want to be. And the medical paradigm is based in a paradigm that privileges mind above body and thinks of mental health symptoms as problems to be solved with a pill, primarily. Mm-hmm. So there's an emphasis on results versus an emphasis on the process and really being in the process, and the process being where the healing really does happen is in slowly, carefully, gently being with the process rather than the focus on how you feel afterwards. I think there's a misconception perhaps in culture that psychedelics are sort of this magic pill that you take and then you feel better. And in my own work, what I've really discovered is very carefully picking that story apart and helping someone understand that, no, this isn't a magic pill. And actually much of this experience might be quite unpleasant. And you know, being in informed consent with someone about what they are saying yes to. So taking the time to unwind their projections and expectations before they send themselves into an experience can be a very helpful part of someone's preparation process.
Yeah, I would love actually to talk about that, sort of a little more about how you start that work, the preparation work with people, especially clients coming to you for trauma, sexual trauma. Mm-hmm. What sort of the work of setting an intention looks like, how you support someone in even sort of just calibrating, like the compass, you know, what direction are we even moving in when they're probably coming to you fairly dissociated, disoriented? Like, what does that look like?
You know, my primary focus when someone new is coming to work with me is establishing safety and rapport, because so many of the folks who come to me are coming for work around sexual trauma, and often, even if there's trauma at an adult age, many of them are survivors of childhood abuse in some form. So my own intention as they're coming to me is to really develop excellent communication within the field and to understand their own history around safety and consent and boundaries, and start to get curious about where their edges might be, their growth edges around developing that. So if someone is coming to me for support and they're going to go do expanded state work, I, you know, often encourage them to ask a lot of questions about the container they're in, because there isn't one way of holding ceremonial work or therapeutic work, and different people come from different backgrounds, and the issues that plague our culture around abuse and violence and power dynamics are also present within the field of psychedelic work. And so really understanding, you know, there's so many differences. Are they going to a group? Okay, well, who's leading the group? How many assistants are there? What are the boundaries around touch? You know, what kind of support will they get if they have a hard time? How do they ask for support? The same questions go for individual work. If they're doing individual work with someone, I'm assuming most people are doing work with support of some kind. Right. You know, if you're doing work on your own, it's a totally different ballgame. But in individual work, well, who is that person? What is their background? How do you, with that person, make sure that the container is very clear before your state is altered? Because once your state is altered, you can no longer consent, really, or you can only consent to the highest level of intimacy you've consented to prior to an experience, which can be very hard for some people, I think, you know, particularly folks who are doing attachment work. They may have one boundary prior to an experience. I've seen this with clients reporting to me afterwards, and then when in an expanded state experience, they're like, well, no, but actually I do want touch now. Well, and so how do you navigate that? That's tricky, right? Because one thing was true before, but now you're expanded and this other thing is true. And best practices would say you don't override the boundary you set before going into that container, even if the idea seems really good at the time. Because when you're in an expanded state, you are more open, you are more suggestible, you are more porous. And it might feel really amazing in the moment. And then afterwards, you're like, wait, all of me wasn't ready for that. Right. So as much clarity as there can be in a container helps. So, you know, having someone understand if they're working with a single guide or they're working with a shaman, often with in a group, there isn't much as much room to ask these questions about, well, what is this person holding this work as? You know, are they oriented to it as healing work? Are they oriented to it as transforming trauma? Are they oriented to it as therapy? Because, you know, how a guide or a therapist or a shaman holds a container is going to also affect what's happening there and shape it. So finding, you know, I encourage my clients to find people they feel resonance with, to look for a sense of trust in someone.
You know, talking about sort of the part of you that, or the part of one that might feel ready for touch and another part that might not, and then, you know, the guide or whoever needs to be equipped to handle the part that might feel rejected at them, you know, even doing the right thing and maintaining those boundaries. It's so nuanced.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how a guide navigates their own experience, or a therapist, right? That's true of therapy too. You know, we offer an intervention to our clients and they're like, nah, and you're like, oh, you didn't like that. How do we not take it personally? Or take it personally to the degree that we need to reflect on how we offered an intervention and why we offered it and what our intentions were. And it's such a tightrope of taking nothing personally while also doing the work of self-reflection.
Right, right. Yeah. And as the work, you know, unfolds and your clients, you know, begin their medicine work, or maybe they're already engaged in it when they come to you, maybe some are already doing that work when they come to you, I would love to talk a little more about the integration process.
Yeah.
And what that really looks like.
Yeah, integration is such a fascinating process to me.
I'm so fascinated by it. That's literally why I'm doing this. I just can't get enough of sort of hearing what it looks like and means to people.
Yeah. Well, it's so individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all well and good to have incredible moments of insight and change in a journey, and then actually what's different afterwards. That's to me where the rubber really meets the road, and the difference between continued bypass versus transformation. So for me, so much of integration is embodied, because this is what we got, this is what's happening, here's the material realm, and so how does integration live in one's embodied experience? You know, if I come out of a journey where I've done a lot of work around fear or holding or a pattern of contraction where I roll my shoulders inwards, you know, is my integration practice then to become more aware of how I might create more space across my collarbone and let my shoulder blades rest down my back? And there was a journey I had years ago where I was working with the sensation of having wings. I had this image of a wing sprout across my left shoulder, and afterwards there was such a sense of space. And so, you know, my integration practice became bringing that sense of space back up in my embodied awareness and resting in it and exploring it and notice how I resist it and what comes up when I resist it and what comes up when I rest in it, you know, this whole world to explore. And integration may look like cooking yourself a meal. It can be very simple. I think what I've learned about integration is making it hard as a setup for failure. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely guilty of this. I'll come out of a journey and be like, okay, today's the day I start my 365-day meditation practice, and I'm going to sit for an hour every day. It's going to be awesome. And that never happens. Right. That's, you know, that's not. It's a reflection of how juiced up we feel emerging from those spaces and how much of a sense of effulgence and capacity we have. And that's beautiful. And then also to sort of take that energy and bring it into grounded form. That's where the skill around integration really happens. And so to think carefully with someone about what's something that's small and accomplishable. You know, what's one thing you can realistically do every day, given the limitations of time and space and one's life, to take an insight or an experience that comes from a journey that feels valuable or important, that you want to explore, that you want to sustain, that feels like the way your intention is unfolding, and how does that weave out into your life? It becomes like an artistic practice in many ways. Integration as an art form, you know, and then this word integration is, I'm an etymology nerd, so I like to go in the Oxford English Dictionary and look at the etymological roots of things. And integration is really about making whole or to render untouched. And so that's an interesting, for me, that's an interesting place of integration as both the process of transformation, but also a process of recovery and remembrance, and thinking about living in a system of patriarchy or a system of oppression, and how that really dismembers us on so many different levels, literally or psychically or emotionally or spiritually. We're so cut off from these different parts of ourselves. And so in myself, integration has really become this process of making whole, of recovering the parts of myself that I've cut off, or that culture has cut off from me, because they don't fit into the mold, and psychically suturing them back into my life, of making them part of me again, of bringing the wholeness of myself out, which is both a recovery and a transformation, because as I recover these parts of myself, there's enormous power and possibility and gifts that have been shut away there that I then get to explore how they want to come out in the world. You know, I'm interested in integration as sort of a symbolic act, right? We live in this beautifully symbolic world. And so what is the living symbol that one wants to make one's life? You know, how does your life reflect the complexity and the facets of who you are, and become a symbol of that? You know, we're all reflecting things to each other all the time. It's a weird hall of mirrors. So what is the symbol a person is creating in their life at any given moment?
This is giving me so much to reflect on. You know, so much of my work I'm learning is about slowing down and resisting urgency. And so it's almost like every time I come out of a journey and there's that urgent, like, I should do this thing to totally overhaul my life. Like, now it's almost like that's a test. And like, I have to, that's definitely not what I should do right away or ever. But I'm now really thinking about, okay, so what part of that, what part of myself is that that has been lost that needs to be reclaimed? What is the part of myself that can take it slow, that can trust my own timeline? And I hadn't really considered it that way. I had been focused so much on, well, that's the part of me that always does X, Y, Z, versus like, what's the part of me that doesn't have a voice here?
Yeah. You know, in the body of work I've been developing, somadelics, really thinking about the different, I really like parts work, Richard Schwartz's work, but thinking about the different parts of ourselves, and how, as we've internalized oppression, that oppression expresses in how we relate to the different facets of ourselves. So, you know, because I've grown up and I live in a culture that treats the mind as the ruler, my mind is really my slave driver, that I hold my mind as the arbiter of logic and the one who should be making all decisions, and that I self-oppress, that I oppress the sort of feeling senses of my body. And so my work of recovery is to reestablish equity within that relationship between mind and body, to have some education in restorative and transformative justice. And so, you know, those forms of justice are about restoring relationship and repairing harm. And so understanding how my mind, how I've harmed my body, you know, not that it's my fault necessarily, it's no one's fault, right? We just live in this crazy world. But that the work I can attend to is to bringing mind and body, or body and spirit, or mind and heart, these facets, I have these four facets of embodiment, radiant embodiment, to bring them into equitable and harmonious relationship with each other, to really let my living system be in the fullness of itself, and to be in right relationship, you know, that term, where everybody's communicating with each other, where everybody has a seat at the table.
And what do you notice with your clients as this work unfolds? Obviously, without asking for super specific details, but it sounds like shifts, you know, you see like people setting boundaries, or even relating to their bodies differently. Just what types of things do you see?
I see people claiming their power and their agency. And to me, that's such an exciting moment where, I mean, we're perpetually realizing it, but the moments of like, oh, I'm co-creating this. I'm interested in exploring with my clients the narratives that are the most empowering to them. So we're always making up stories about what has happened to us and what's happening to us right now, but what are the narratives that the stories that we tell ourselves that leave us with the most power and the most choice in any given scenario? And what do we learn about who we are from those stories? And then what are the stories we want to tell about ourselves in the future? And how do we choose? Because that's really all we have is choice about how we respond in any given moment. How do we choose as we're steering the ship of our lives to honor what we have, which is that we're a being of the cosmos, and the whole of the cosmos and all of the powers of the cosmos exist inside us. And when are we choosing that, and when are we denying that? And so this power and agency, choice is such a, to me, a marker of when someone is really stepping into themselves. They're inhabiting their seat in a different way. And it looks different for every person, but I would say a marker is that people feel better, or they feel empowered. It's such a difficult, challenging my capacity for language here. But what does it feel like when you're really in your power? Well, you know it because you know what it feels like in your body. To me, it feels a little bit like being plugged into an electrical outlet. There's a sense of like, I'm here, I'm in my fullness, and I have something to offer that wants to come out. And then what are the places where it wants to come out? How is one being an active co-creator in their own life? How are they shaping their world while also honoring the complexity of like, we don't control everything, and we live in a very complicated system that wants to undermine people's personal power and agency, and particularly if they're from a background that is of, black or brown skin, or are female or queer, right? There are all these shaping forces that work to undermine our power. But my hope, and what I think I see as possible, is that with specific targeted psychedelic work, we can really become agents of transformation. That the body, the original word for body, comes from this old Germanic bodig, which is a word for an alchemical vessel. And the alchemists actually modeled their transformational vessels on those living systems of the body. So it's a little bit goes both ways. But this idea that this material reality that we live is quite a powerful agent of change, and that as we come to know that and really inhabit the fullness of that, that we can become shapers of change. Right, Octavia Butler, like shape change, shape God. And hopefully shape a better world. I would say that is also a marker, not to say that everyone needs to be oriented to shaping the world. I think shaping the world comes in all different kinds of shapes and sizes, and the role of the artist is absolutely as sacred as the role of the healer or the doctor. And right, energy changes in lots of different ways and forms. But that people that I see my clients stepping into their calling and their gifts, and bringing those forward in a way that feels good to them, that honors who they are.
And I know you're working on your book. Is that sort of the synthesis of like this framework or?
The book, it is. The book also emerged somewhat out of my dissertation. I had a lot of people who wanted to read my dissertation, but it's academic. And if you ever read a dissertation, your fourth chapter is usually your literature review, which is like, here's what everybody said about this topic. And I had folks come back to me and be like, well, I did really well until I got to chapter four. I was like, okay. Didn't even get to the good stuff. Yeah, so I'm writing a book right now. It's Somadelics, offering people a path to cultivate this. I think people have a lot of tools already, and I see the contemporary frame in which psychedelic work is being potentiated in as one that's happening really in the medical model, and I have my desire to shift that a little bit and to introduce more of the mystical and the spiritual, and to really bring in these frames of restorative and transformative justice into how we're working in these spaces, and to do it overtly, not just in someone's background or training. So Somadelics is a path of embodied psychedelic mysticism, but it's really focused on the alchemy of trauma in service of collective liberation, and so walking people through the map of Somadelics is the map of the body, the heart, the mind, and the spirit, and exploring how those live in relationship to each other, how patterns of domination live in those facets of ourselves, and how they relate to each other, and how we can use psychedelic and expanded states to transform them. So it's lots of fun and a lot of work.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing. It's so challenging, right? Being people in who work within the medical system to some degree as like licensed providers, which we both are, but who also just want to kind of burn it all down from the inside. And I'm so excited for the work you're doing. I feel like it's, to me, it just makes so much sense the way you're integrating these different resources and frameworks and
Thanks. Yeah, it's a labor of love, and I'm very much a creative and an artist at heart, but language is one of my mediums of choice, and so there's a desire to bridge. I want to burn it all down, but I want to build people a bridge first and tell them why they should walk over it before I burn it. And and so this is my offering right now. This is the best way I can think of to be of service to the world, and also to my own process. It really puts me on the hook. It's like, oh, I have to integrate and embody this on a very deep level before I can feel good about offering it out. So there's nothing like making a public offering to do that for me.
Like some real accountability.
Like a podcast.
Something like that, for
Yeah.
example. When can people expect the book, or is there a estimated
Good
timeline?
question. Well, I'm in process with writing, and this spring I will be hopefully talking with agents and editors, in that navigating that. But folks are certainly welcome to. I offer Somadelics classes, so if you go to somadelics.com or valeriamccarroll.com, you can find your way to my work. I'm very interested in harmonizing myself with the cycles of nature, and so I like to offer a class, every solstice or equinox, a ritual, guided ritual to help mark that transition and support people in setting intentions for the next turning of the wheel. And I'm in process of developing other offerings too, but those are the main opportunities to connect with me in a public way right now.
Great. And is your practice open just to folks in California?
So I am licensed just in California, so that's where folks can find me.
Great. I'll include links to everything and all of that info in the show notes. And you'll have to keep me posted on the
Of
book. You'll have to
course.
come back.
I'd love
And
to.
yeah, that would be great. Thank
That'd
you
be
so
fun.
much. This
Oh.
is given me a lot to think about, both in my clinical work and in my personal work, and I'm just so grateful.
My pleasure.
So that's the show. Thanks so much for listening. Make sure to head to the show notes for all the links and ways that you can get in touch with both Valeria and myself. Make sure to keep an eye out for her book, Somadelics. I can't wait to read it myself when it comes out, and I hope Valeria will come back to talk about it at that time. If you liked this episode, if you're liking the podcast, do me a favor and feel free to subscribe, rate, review, share it, whatever feels right for you. Everything helps and goes a long way. I would really appreciate it. And in any case, I hope you'll keep listening and let me know if there's anyone you want to hear on the show talking about psychedelic integration. Or if that's you, feel free to reach out and let me know. Thanks so much, and I'll talk to you soon.